So good evening, everyone. Welcome. Good to see you all here. Another beautiful late summer evening. Well, Kate has told me my Dharma talks are too long. especially for this new seminar that we're starting, because we're also including a service to allow people to work on practicing the instruments as well as, of course, for us to be able to enjoy service. So she's probably right, and I'm going to try to speak very fast. I'll try and make my other ones a bit shorter. So this is the beginning of a new series that we're going to be talking about on the foundations of Buddhism. And it's probably a good idea in two ways. One, just to remind us of some of the key ideas and foundations about our practice and how they resonate with us at this particular moment. And also to prepare us for our practice period, which is going to be starting at the end of September, when we're going to be looking at the various teachings that our Chinese ancestors have left for us to enjoy and to see how they resonate with our life. So this will hopefully kind of give us or remind us of the foundation of our practice and our view of the world. And then we'll see what our ancient Chinese ancestors have to say to us. I'd like to start off by quickly saying there's no such thing as Buddhism. That we use this word a lot in both the academic world and, of course, in the world of practice. But really, there is no such thing as Buddhism. There is a Buddhist tradition, there is a flow of ideas, but there's nothing static or unchanging about this particular tradition. Buddhism, as is practiced throughout time, has varied greatly. And Buddhism, as it's practiced in different places, varies greatly as well. Now, sometimes I think, well, then what are we talking about? And there are some areas, foundational concepts or ideas that are helpful and that have certainly resonated throughout time, from the time of the Buddha all the way up until now. And so in this series, that's what we're going to be kind of focusing on. And I'll certainly use the word Buddhism, but I use the word cautiously and encourage you to use it cautiously well. Don't assume that the person you're facing understands this particular Buddhist tradition in the same way that you do. Perhaps we could say that about many words. Love, for example. Relationship. We get in a lot of trouble with our assumptions. So back to the beginning. So the Buddha, that is really a title, and it basically means a person who is awake, the awakened one. And means awake to the truth of this world, the deep, profound, foundational, flowing, constantly changing truth of what it means to be alive, to be a human being here under these conditions. Free of delusion. In other words, free of the stories, the desires, the aversions that we experience almost daily. In fact, almost minute by minute. Free of those, simply to be alive, meeting your life moment after moment, fully engaged. A Buddha, as some of the old texts say, kind of knows how it is. And the average person kind of wallows in confusion. So it's kind of put in contrast. But as we see, that it's not really quite right either. As I said a little bit earlier, there are many ways to look or to consider what Buddhism is or the Buddhist tradition. But I think the very central message, at least the one that I feel is the central message that echoes all the way up until the modern times, is the call to practice. The call to practice the Dharma, to practice the teachings, and come to see for oneself the truth of your own life, the truth of the way things really are, rather than through our distorted, slightly twisted view and understanding. So in this sense, the focus of the Buddhist tradition is not on belief, it's not on knowledge, but on practice and on action. In the academic world, they talk about this as being orthopraxy, as opposed to orthodoxy. Orthodoxy means the true knowledge or true understanding. Orthopraxy means the practice, the true practice. So, of course, in the Buddhist tradition, the path is well described, and knowledge of it is helpful, of course. We need to study some. But the emphasis is always on directly seeing and experiencing the truth of one's life. In other words, the Buddhist tradition is really concerned about bringing about liberation from our crimped views, freedom from our states of confusion. And so in this way, we can express our full nature. Another way to put it is the foundation of practice is realizing our usual confused ways of seeing the world as somehow being separate, right? Cut off. Somehow we see the world as out there. I'm here. Somewhere in here. You're all out there. We're separate. Somehow we need to put that view down and open to the innate intimacy of everything with everything that surrounds us. Now, there are many metaphors in the Buddhist tradition illustrating our confused vision of the world. Maybe you've heard of a number of these, that we're asleep, we're dreaming, we're entranced, we're caught in our own stories, we are somehow blind. These are just some examples of the ways that the Buddhist tradition has talked about the confusion that we live much of our life under. And the very story of Siddhartha, who became the Buddha, is really a classic illustration of our inherent confused or deluded ways of viewing the world. And as you probably already know, according to the mythology, Siddhartha grew up under the very careful protection of his father, who was a king, or at least a very powerful individual, who wished to prevent his son from taking up the religious life, which had been prophesied by a holy man at the birth of Siddhartha. And his father wanted him to be a king, as he was. And so his father tried to prevent Siddhartha from taking up the religious life by sheltering him from all forms of suffering. Right? Because isn't that what makes us begin practice or think about religious questions in the first place? So no suffering. And really, it was only as a young man that Siddhartha became painfully aware of the true nature of human existence, that we are all subject to sickness, old age, and death, that those people that he deeply loved, his wife, his newborn child, his father, his mother, would also become ill, old, suffer from old age, and die. In the Buddhist tradition, these are known as the sights, the things that he saw, the sights that sparked this new, strong awareness in Siddhartha. And often they're referred to as the three messengers. And really, Siddhartha's story is our own, isn't it? At some point in our life, sooner or later, depending on our circumstances, we are shaken, and we are shaken awake, even for a brief while. And so we begin to question the foundation of who we are and how we live. I think most of us here are familiar with Siddhartha's journey of leaving home and then practicing many different practices and finally ending up under what today we call the Bodhi tree. And he sat in deep meditation. And through this meditation, experienced insight into the human condition. And then shortly afterwards, he met other holy men who had been practicing with him at a place known as Deer Park. And there, the Buddha, now having this title, the one who is awake, gave his first sermon. Deer Park, I meant, is near Benares, which is now called, has a different name now, isn't it?
Varanasi was the old name in Benares.
Benares is the new name? Oh, okay, well, I had it reversed. Thank you. So there he gave what today we recognize as the Four Noble Truths, the kind of essence, perhaps, we could say, of the Buddhist teachings. At least that's how we understand it today. And I think very interestingly, these Four Noble Truths are presented in the manner of a medical diagnosis and prescription. In other words, what's the problem? Let's examine what the cause of the problem is. Here's a prescription, and then you do it. You take the medicine, do the exercises, right? That kind of medical way of looking at it. So the Four Noble Truths go like this. First of all is the truth of suffering or dissatisfaction, the truth of dukkha, that we experience this almost constantly through our life in either subtle or strong ways, and I'll come back and talk about that in a moment. Now, the second is that this dissatisfaction, this dukkha that we experience, is not caused by the world. It's caused by our craving and attachment to those things we consider to be the cause of our very happiness. Or dukkha is caused by our aversion to what we consider to be the causes of our unhappiness. Third noble truth is that dukkha ends when craving and aversion, our craving and aversion, comes to an end. And the third noble truth, that kind of going to be expanding on that, that there is a way that we can resolve our craving and our aversion. And that is the fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path, laid out by the Buddha. But we'll talk about the Eightfold Path next week, right? And so tonight we'll kind of quickly look through the first three noble truths, kind of touch base on those again. So the first noble truth, as I said, is the truth of suffering or dissatisfaction. And often we hear a kind of shorthand version, at least that you used to hear it be pretty popular, that life is suffering. But, it's true the Buddha did say that. It doesn't mean life sucks and you die. He very clearly said, even though there may be times in your life when it feels like that, like junior high school, for some people, that's not the case at all. The Buddha taught we need, of course, to recognize and be open to and indeed to cultivate our joy, our compassion, and our equanimity. But he was very clear and stated in a number of texts. He said, formally and now, what I teach is dukkha or suffering, dissatisfaction, and the cessation of dukkha, the cessation of dissatisfaction. And this dukkha does not necessarily mean like strong physical pain or anguish, but rather the kind of mental suffering we undergo when we tend to try to hold on to our pleasurable encounters, or when we're confronted, for example, with the fleeting nature of life, or our experiences become unsatisfying, unmanageable, unwanted. So it goes like this. Hit by, say, the arrow of, say, a lover who's leaving you for good, a car accident that you have, or you receive a poor medical diagnosis, an unfortunate medical diagnosis, or even something just like a friend you get annoyed with because they're chronically late all the time. At those times, we often shoot ourselves with the second arrow. Right? The first arrow is life hits us with something. The second arrow is we shoot ourselves because we begin to lament our situation. We begin to rebel, push against, want it to be different than it is. We cry out, get me out of here. It is natural, of course, that we individually and collectively work to reduce suffering, whether it's a minor or annoyance or a great calamity. We exercise, for example, to circumvent some of the limitations of aging. We avoid troublesome people. Maybe we use substances to help ease us through rough patches in our life. However, over time, I think we all come to see that our usual ways of coping are not enough. That the promises various people and companies perhaps have made to us to create happiness, to make us into happy individuals, that those promises fall short. And then we are confused, maybe even desperate, and we start to seek a truer relief. Why do I suffer? What have I done to deserve this unhappiness? I think these are kind of fundamental questions that we, as human beings, have collectively asked in so many ways all throughout our history. Why? The Buddha summed up a discussion that his monks had like this. So this is the time of the Buddha. He said, you guys are talking, this is my idea of what you're saying. I am a victim of birth, aging, and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an end of this whole mass of suffering can be known. Isn't that us? At times, right? I think every one of us has a story of what brought us to practice. And in this way, we're not alone. We're not alone in our confusion and that sense of isolation that we feel. So that's dukkha. Dukkha, maybe we could say, is a response to the afflictive conditions of our life. So the Buddha, fully appreciating the nature of dukkha, of human dissatisfaction in its myriad forms, then turned his attention to the cause of dukkha, which he formulated into the second noble truth. Quoting an early text, now this, monks, is the noble truth of the origin of dukkha. It is this craving that leads to renewed existence, accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there, that is, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, etc. So the cause of dukkha, the Buddha is pointing out, is craving. Craving and its partner in crime, aversion, right, which is kind of the flip side, right, of craving. Give me that, take that away. These two are the roots of dukkha. And so if we address these roots of craving and aversion, perhaps the dukkha then can be undone. We no longer need to suffer that second arrow. Now the word in Pali, one of the early languages that the texts are written in, is tanha, which means thirst. And I really like this word. Much better than craving, I think. Because tanha, thirst, is a type of desire that is, first of all, pervasive in our lives, and it's very persistent, and it's reoccurring. Pervasive, persistent, and reoccurring. Pervasive in that the mind is constantly telling us that we need something and that we need it now, if not sooner. Right? When I sat down to write this, one of my first thoughts was, I should get something to drink before I get involved in this. And don't you notice that? You sit down to watch a video and suddenly you're going, popcorn or chocolate or something, right? It's just amazing how that happens. Or even when we're talking to our partner, right? We're kind of waiting for them to pause so we can interject and get our smart comments in. And yet once a craving is satisfied, once you've got your chocolate, your popcorn, then a new craving arises shortly afterwards. Tanha keeps directing our attention to new things and places. And the moment a flicker of boredom occurs, it's like, okay, give me something else. Give me something else. And the kind of sickness of this is we tend to somehow imagine unconsciously that once I get this thing, I'll be satisfied. Then it will stop, right? Then I'll just sit and watch the rest of the movie. But that satisfaction is never really very permanent. Something more is soon needed. Something different is required to be happy. So the other aspect of tanha is wanting our present condition to be different than it is. And this is, of course, aversion, right? I don't want to get stuck in traffic. I don't want to be sick. Just skipping ahead a little bit here so I can give you some time to talk here. So the Buddha taught we must look carefully at our experience of tanha, or experience of craving. And we shouldn't simply gratify it or turn away, but really to look into its nature. What is this craving like? What is this aversion really like? Where do I feel it in the body? What qualities does it have? Where do I feel the pull? Or the push? How intense is it? And when does it arise? And if I don't do anything, what happens to it? These are the kind of practices we can do sitting on the cushion, for example, watching, not engaging, allowing it to arise and to cease. Now, one more quick word I want to say. Sometimes we tend to think all desires, we need to get rid of all our desires, but that's the Buddhist teaching. But that's not quite right. Very clearly, there are wholesome desires that we actually should cultivate. The desire to be compassionate, the desire to follow the path, examples. Our wish or desire for the well-being of those we love and other people. These are all recognized as wholesome desires. And how do we decide whether it's wholesome or unwholesome, a desire that we have? Well, unfortunately, there's no easy answer. But in thinking about the difference between wholesome and unwholesome, I think one element we need to always consider is how self-centered is this desire? Is this focused on me or not? And if it's not focused on me, wholesome desires are nurtured with patience and insight, right? My desire to end homelessness, desire to bring about a healthy earth again. These are all desires that we should cultivate, nurture. allow them to grow with patience and insight. So finally, the third noble truth comes directly from the second one, that the end of suffering comes with the end of clinging and aversion. The famous Thai teacher, Achan Cha, said this: if you let go a little, you'll have a little happiness. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of happiness. If you let go completely, you'll be completely happy. Let go of your clinging and aversion. So, in our meditation practice, we can sit with craving and aversion, perhaps, watch it grow, watch it arise, watch it cease, see how it is in the body. And this is a practice we do through the day. Abandon our craving, abandon our aversion, simply by being mindful of it, not acting. What's it like? So I'll stop there. I tried to make it a little bit shorter. I think I succeeded. And now I'd like to give you some time to talk together a little bit. And we'll get in triads again, our old practice. So we'll get in groups of three. And the practice will be this. I'll give each person approximately 2 minutes to speak. I'm going to give you a couple of questions in just a moment here. And you have that full 2 minutes. The other people just listen carefully. And then when I ring the bell, you'll change and the next person will be able to speak. And please don't refer to what someone else has said. Just speak your own truth, from your own experience or what you want to talk about. So we don't cross-talk. And if you say you finish everything you wanted to say in a minute and a half, you still have some time left, the three of you just sit in companionable silence. And if something springs back to mind, you can, of course, begin to talk again. The last thing I'll say about this, just to remind us, is whatever is said here in the triads just stays here. So please don't bring it up outside when we have tea and cookies or also, unless the other person does. So we have a kind of a safe place just to talk about what we feel comfortable to talk about. I think that's all I need to say about that.
So, would you like us to talk about
yes. So, you know, in your own life, do you remember a time when you became particularly aware of one of the three messengers of sickness, old age, and death, when it deeply touched you and you realized somehow life was different than you assumed it to be? Just as the Buddha did. What was that like for you? So that's one possibility. The other one is, how do you habitually respond to discomfort and dissatisfaction? Right? What's your go-to escape hatch when you feel discomfort, dissatisfaction? And is that really, for you now looking at it, is that healthy, wholesome? Or how would you like to respond instead? Okie dokie.